Monster Man, special episode, Dragons in Chinese Mythology.
Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games.
Today's episode is a special episode, brought to you by the generosity and public spirit of Patreon backer Mari. If you'd like to be like Mari and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you pledge at that level, in addition to your own special episode, you'll also get other bonus content, like irregular bonus episodes, and my very regular extra podcast, Patron Deities, in which I give the Monster Man treatment to the Deities and Demigods book. Also, before we get started, I'd like to remind everyone that I've got a couple of new things out that you can read and enjoy. My pamphlet adventure for Troika, the world's other favorite fantasy role-playing game, is up now on Itch, and I also contributed a scenario to Dissident Whispers, which is an anthology of one very big page, depends how you look at it, dungeons or scenarios for a variety of different role-playing games. Mine statted for OSE-ish, but there are plenty in there, and all the proceeds go to support bail funds. So you can go ahead and check those out. There are links up on my Patreon and Libsyn pages, and my Twitter. Alright, let's talk about dragons in Chinese mythology. Now, we have already discussed this back in Season 2, when we discussed the dragon, Oriental entry in the Fiend Folio, and I don't want to spend too long covering that previous information, so let's begin by recapping what we've already established, and then we'll see where we go from there. Now, the Fiend Folio attributes to these types of dragon many of the different powers that they have in Chinese literature and Chinese mythology. So things like ESP, the ability to polymorph, to become invisible, the ability to command other creatures. They specifically command scaly creatures, which I think is a really interesting image. The ability to create water fire, this kind of strange elemental energy. And of course, to spread panic or terror, particularly in sort of weaker creatures, lower hit die creatures. And you get six types of dragon in this entry. The Li Long or Earth Dragon, the Long Wang or Sea Dragon, the Pan Long or Coil Dragon, the Shen Long or Spirit Dragon, the Tian Long or Celestial Dragon, and the Yu Long or Carp Dragon. Now, some of those seem to be quite important in Chinese literature and lore about dragons, and others not so much. What these dragon types tend to have in common is that, unlike European dragons, who I think we can agree are more characteristically associated with fire or, to a lesser extent, poison, the Chinese dragon imagery is very focused on air and water. And of course, I want to say that we're talking about a literary and mythological tradition that spans a very long period of history and a very wide geographical range. So we're going to get a great deal of variation of these beliefs, and we can only skim the surface of them. So we're going to take a look at some images that occur in this art and in this literature and in this mythology, and how we can be inspired by those images for use in games, but I would never claim that this is like an accurate, well, I try to be accurate, but it's certainly not complete summary of these stories. So, as I said, Chinese dragons tend to be associated with water and specifically with weather, so with flooding and with storms. And this can be seen in a number of myths. So, for example, we talked back in the Chinese mythos section of Patron Deities about the rebellion of Chi Yu and how a dragon helped the Yellow Emperor deal with it. And there, that involved flooding and drought. We talked about how Emperor Yu was once nearly borne away by some dragons, and he overcame them with philosophical determination, I guess. But of course, you know, he is a character who is known for his association with flood control. And the importance of water is both literal, in terms of the importance of water in an agrarian society, and it's also metaphorical in that water is associated with a yang, the positive male generative force. So dragons are said to have 81 yang scales and 36 yin scales on their bodies. And so dragons are associated with life-giving yang. And that's something that we're going to see in a number of beliefs or practices associated with dragons. physically, they're described in a number of ways, as composite animals in some cases. So I think I quoted this last time as well. This is in Martin Arnold's book, but this is a quote from the 1st to 2nd century AD scholar Wang Fu, and he wrote that the dragon has, or that he actually says people depict dragons as having, the antlers of a stag, the head of a camel, the eyes of a demon, the neck of a snake, the belly of a clam, the scales of a carp, the claws of an eagle, the soles of a tiger, and the ears of a cow. And that some, but not all dragons, have a bulge on their heads representing the organ that allows them to fly. And this is true in D&D as well, where we see that some species of dragon have this organ and some don't. So some can fly and some can't. So there are a wide variety of different sources that ascribe different powers to dragons. Essentially, it kind of a wizard did it. Whatever ability is necessary for the story, dragons can have it. So obviously flying, controlling the weather, other kinds of powers relating to water. So for example, some dragons steal all the water in a region and hide it in some big jars, and they take the jars away with them, turning into different animals. Did I say that? So for example, the Shenlong is a dragon who is partly responsible for like thunderstorms and other weather phenomena, but they're kind of lazy, so they will turn into a mouse and go hide so that they don't have to do their jobs. So when lightning strikes like a haystack or some thatch, that's probably because a Shenlong in mouse form was sleeping there, and heaven was just like, get back to work, you lazy slacker. Here's a lightning bolt to remind you of your responsibilities. Probably because they're associated with such important and powerful natural forces, dragons are also symbols of power and authority, that the taming of them is representative of both kind of personal spiritual authority and the majesty of the law. Historically, at different periods, emperors have worn dragon emblems to indicate, again, just that they're, you know, that they're so powerful and so important that their authority can subdue the natural forces represented by dragons. They become identified with the dragon, right? In the same way that, you know, rulers tend to associate themselves with powerful and majestic real and mythological animals. So how do we translate this body of legend into a fantasy role-playing game, and particularly a fantasy role-playing game that already has a distinct and relatively rigid model for what dragons are? If you're a subscriber to that model, which I personally am not, like in general, I like dragons to be individualized. I've said this before in a number of different dragon episodes, and I don't want to go into it again. I just think it makes them cooler. And I should add that there's an existing categorization of dragons by color in Chinese literature. So apparently Emperor Huizong divided dragons into five categories, and he said that they correspond to five different types of rulers. Blue dragons relate to rulers who are compassionate and courageous. Red dragons refer to rulers who bring pleasure and bestow blessings. Yellow dragons refer to rulers who spread literacy and convey the prayers of the people to the gods. White dragons represent rulers who are virtuous and pure, and black dragons represent rulers who have mystical powers. I think that's pretty cool, actually. I like the idea, and I assume that what this connects to is existing associations of those colors in Chinese art, or Chinese thought. You know, white already represents purity, and red already represents kind of pleasure and happiness. I think that makes sense in terms of, you know, the way red is kind of associated with, like, celebrations in Chinese art and design. Again, not an expert, but that's just seems to me to make sense. If we're in a world of individualized dragons, then I think this is easy. If we're in a world where we have the existing, like, chromatic and metallic dragons of Dungeons & Dragons, I think, honestly, the thing to do is just not call these things dragons. You know? Because the distinction, quote, oriental, close quotes, and I really don't like that term, dragons, doesn't make any sense in a fantasy setting. And secondly, in a fantasy setting, you certainly can't call them Chinese. That doesn't make any sense either. So I think you could just call them Lung, you know? I mean, okay, it just means dragons, but I just use the name for them, you know? And we already do that with a number of other creatures, right? I mean, bugbear and hobgoblin are basically synonyms, and yet we consider those to be distinct creatures, so, you know, why not? Once you've got those in the way, I think there are two more things to add. First is that we've got dragon kings. They are particularly powerful. They are associated with seas. We saw them when we looked at the animated film Ne Zha Conquers the Dragon King back in the Chinese Mythos section of deities and demigods. Honestly, dragons belong a bit more in the deities and demigods section in Chinese mythology. There's not a whole lot of stories of, like, plucky heroes slaying them. They're not really slayable characters, although there are one or two exceptions. Secondly, there are examples of humans who become dragons when they die, typically. You know, people who are particularly powerful, particularly enlightened, may almost ascend to dragonhood. We've seen mortals becoming divine in Chinese mythology already, in the case of characters like Guan Yu. So, yeah, I mean, that's interesting. I think it would be an interesting path for an NPC to be trying to achieve, right? Otherwise inexplicable actions can be understood when you realize that what this person is trying to do is become one of these water and weather controlling long dragons. So, the dragon's role in Chinese literature, Chinese legend, implies a number of possible game scenarios. The first is the obvious one, which is that the Dragon King is annoyed, causing floods. Something has, you know, offended the Dragon King, whether that's because, you know, traditional sacrifices have been neglected, or whether because some other kind of supernatural creature is encroaching on his territory. Those are all things that would frustrate a Dragon King and lead to weird weather phenomena, right? Typhoons, floods, maybe droughts. I mean, it all depends. And if it's floods, and if dragons have this power of scaly command, then this finally gives you an opportunity to use the bonanza of weird fish monsters that are, for some reason, in the monster manual, right? Remember when I said that it's weird that there are so many underwater monsters in the monster manual and its sequels to a certain extent, because very few games spend all that much time underwater. Well, I need you to envision me tapping the side of my brow here, because what if we just take the game's normal landscape and put it underwater? Now we can throw in underwater monsters to our heart's content. And so the PCs can set out to turn aside the wrath of the Dragon King by doing, you know, whatever quest it is that the Dragon King needs done. One ceremony that's turned into quite a widespread one that is associated with dragons is the Dragon Boat. People typically describe this holiday as the Dragon Boat Festival. It has ritual origins, although in some cases it is celebrated in a decidedly non-ritual context. So, for example, we have dragon boat racing here in Cambridge. Again, so this takes place during summer. It's associated, I want to say, with rice planting. And again, this is the idea that, you know, the warmth of the sun and water are both associated with yang, the generative life force, and therefore obviously important in terms of agricultural fertility. But rituals that involve a competitive aspect are a good place to involve player characters, although a typical Dragon Boat crew is significantly larger than a player character party, but I guess that's what hirelings are for. I've in fact played in a game where precisely this happened. In order to make a good impression on another group, our characters had to win their Dragon Boat race. And the Dragon Boats are kind of like, not anthropomorphized, but dracopomorphized. They're given these kind of like figureheads in the shape of dragons, and there's a thing where you sort of someone comes along and dots the eyes in at the last moment. You know, that's the finalist, like that's the champagne on the bow of dragon boat racing, I guess. I believe traditionally it was done by a priest, kind of awakening the dragon. That's really cool. I think there's someone who's more familiar with the ins and outs of dragon boat racing could write a really fun dragon boat scenario. Because it feels like there's all kinds of opportunities for meddling, which is usually what people like in sports-based scenarios. In most RPGs, straight athletic contests aren't interesting because they basically just amount to die rolls, right? I mean, I don't think Dragon Boat, you know, look, I was about to say I don't think Dragon Boat Racing has that much strategy to it. What do I know? Maybe it has a ton. It seems like you just try to paddle really fast, but I say that because I don't know anything about it. Next. We've got some dragons that are heavenly, right? So the Tianlong, the heavenly dragon, you find them up in heaven, guarding the palaces of the gods, pulling their chariots, all that sort of thing. And then you've got dragons that are still down on earth and have not yet ascended to heaven. So the Shenlong, the thunder dragon, or the god dragon, would be an example of that. So what would a dragon need in order to ascend to heaven? And how could a band of ragtag cutthroats help it achieve those things? So you could have a dragon with a patron who, you know, maybe it knows that it has opponents within the celestial hierarchy that would like to prevent it from ascending, and so it needs to get these tasks done using some kind of deniable cat's paws. It's one thing where I think the apparently rigid but actually quite fluid structure of a lot of the depictions of the divine world in Chinese mythology really helps in terms of designing adventures, because you can say things like, you know, we need this thing not to come to the eyes of the authorities. We've given examples of dragons helping the authorities. So, for instance, the use of the Yinglong dragon in suppressing the rebellion of Qi Yu. Qi Yu was, of course, allied with the gods of wind and rain, as we discussed back in that season of Patron Deities. So maybe we have a situation where, you know, long ago this dragon once aided the authorities to fight off some rebel god. Now a new crisis has arisen, but it's been so long, like this is all lost in distant prehistory, that you need to go and, I don't know, you know, explore the tomb of the emperor who, you know, who made that arrangement in order to find out how to do it, and so on and so forth. And then, you know, that's a fun little scenario objective. Magical items associated with dragons that could be quest objectives or just useful bits of kit fall into three categories. The first are dragon parts. There are a number of medical and even cosmetic applications for dragon bits, and those could be physical parts of the dragon, so dragon antlers, for example, or they could be byproducts, like, so for instance, dragon saliva is said to have powerful cosmetic properties. Gross. But so a quest for something like that could either mean like some stealth, like sneaking into a dragon's lair and like wiping some drool off of its lip while it sleeps. That could be a fun little thing. Or going to find the corpse of a dragon. I feel like if you are actually killing dragons, you're probably not interested in hawking antlers in the marketplace, right? You're beyond such trivialities. The second is magic items used by dragons. So I mentioned before those drought-causing jars, where the dragon scooped up all the waters into two jars, and this hero goes after them, and he manages to break one of the jars, releasing the water and creating a river. But the other one, the dragons take away, and they leave it in a certain place, and that's the origin of this particular spring. So I like that idea. Like, what are we questing for? The water from this area, without which, of course, it'll suffer from drought. And then finally, we have the dragon's pearl. The fiery pearls that dragons are depicted with are, again, symbols of their sort of mystical power. And there is at least one story of a hard-working peasant lad who finds one, and it causes abundance. So, like, his mother puts it in a jar of rice, and then, like, the next day, the jar is completely full of rice, you know, that was almost empty. But she just put it there for storage. And so she decides, oh, I'll put it in my box of gold. And then the next day, the box is full of gold. Like, that's a very cool kind of fairy tale-y portrayal of something that, again, represents that generative yang power. But of course, it also attracts trouble because bandits learn that this lady has a big box of gold and, furthermore, has a magic thing that if put into a box of gold can make it make even more gold, and so they make her life very difficult until finally her son swallows the pearl, transforming himself into a dragon. The subtext here, and I think that makes sense, you know, something that we see throughout the mythology of dragons in China is that they are not an unmixed blessing. You know, the rain falls on your crops and waters them, but too much rain is bad, or not enough rain. That's that, you know, they're the water nourishes and gives life, but it can also destroy. So the dragons are a bit like that. They're very wise, and they're overall benevolent, but they're very powerful. And when that power is applied, people can get hurt, even if that's not necessarily what the dragons intend, and of course sometimes it is. Now the dragon's pearl is a bit like, it's a MacGuffin. It reminds me a bit of the Sampo in Finnish mythology, where it's just this like source of abundance. And there are problems associated with abundance, but it's not something that you want the player characters to get a hold of, unless you are sick and tired of money being in your game and you'd like to just put a stop to that, in which case, knock yourself out. So I feel like these are all fun ideas that most of them involve some sense that the dragon is tied to or symbolic of natural forces that are larger than or more powerful than the individual, that are beyond individual control, and that, if not harnessed with wisdom or treated with respect, can be very powerful and damaging. And that's quite different from the dragons of sort of conventional D&D, or even of the Western mythology that inspired them. But I would say particularly the D&D dragon is a creature that's, I mean, is an intelligent individual, right? The dragon stands in for a very powerful person, not necessarily an uncontrollable force of nature. We get the idea that chromatic dragons are I mean, they're like people, evil people, but like people, right? They glory in destruction, but they glory. And chromatic dragons tend to be either like, the problem is sometimes they're portrayed as kind of superheroes, which is a bit, but the rest of the time they're sort of wise, detached sages off contemplating the eternal verities somewhere, you know? And I think that the dragons of Chinese mythology don't suit that role very well. You know, they are more like natural forces. Sometimes they're petty and human-like, like when the Dragon Kings get outraged about stuff. But most of the rest of the time, they're either, they've been tamed and they're doing somebody's bidding, or they're just doing what they do. They're moving around the landscape, interacting with the natural world in a way that's more profound than your interaction with it. And they're either don't really understand, or they are above the consequences of those actions as they relate to the lives of ordinary people. Which means that they've got to be handled with care. They're very seldom good candidates for a stand-up fight, and they're also not characters to whom you can just go and explain the problem and they'll fix it. Right? That's the problem with anyone who's not an outright villain in D&D. A lot of the time when you have these very powerful NPCs in the landscape, there's no reason why the PCs wouldn't just go to them and go, hey, by the way, you flooded this village. But here, the dragon will absolutely say, I'm just doing what a dragon does, buddy. That's how we work. And that means that the PCs have got to find a way around the dragon that isn't just imposing their will on it or getting it to impose its will on the world. That makes for interesting problems. And interesting problems require interesting solutions. And interesting solutions, that's what good games are made of. So, Maring, I hope that you enjoyed this episode about dragons in Chinese mythology. There's so much more to talk about, and I wouldn't even know where to begin, really. This is just skimming the surface and using examples, springboarding off them to see how we can incorporate that stuff into games. But I think if you stick to the fundamental idea of dragons as natural forces, or natural and supernatural forces at the same time, then you have a basis for dragons that feel less like European dragons. Again, if you'd like to be like Maring and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level, or if you prefer to, you can pledge at a lower level and just get the rewards there instead. Either way, on Friday we are returning to the Creature Catalog, the 1986 supplement for basic Dungeons & Dragons, and we're going to be taking a look at more animals from the animals section right here on Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.